Okay, it's 9 o'clock, and I'm sure we're going to have a few people coming in. So, but I'm going to go ahead and start, and we'll take a do a few little orders of business and get that out of the way, and then we'll go to introductions. So this is Monday. I'm sorry, Monday. April is April 13th.
No, it's not. Not yet.
Saturday.
CWA should be
2019. Saturday, April 13th, 2019, this is panel number 5106 at the Conference on World Affairs, and we're being recorded today. So first, welcome on this cool, cloudy 9 o'clock on Saturday morning. It's an unusual timing for this event, but it's great. We have good turnout, and welcome to all. My name's Mark McIntyre. I'm really honored to be moderating my first Conference on World Affairs event. It's kind of an honor for me, not only because of the stature of our panelists, but I attended my first Conference on World Affairs in 1978 as a freshman at CU. So I might have been in this room, but anyway, and I, you know, it was a mind-bending experience for me then, and so I'm really honored to be part of this today. My main qualification on my resume for hosting this panel would be I've been around for a long time. but I have been a long-time Boulder resident. And the only other thing I would say in light of our topic is that I do have four generations of family living here. And so discussions of passing economic torches and which way those torches go and how that happens is something that I'm experiencing in my personal life. Again, everyone from grandchildren to parents and in-laws right here in town. So that's about me. What I'm going to do with our panelists this morning was to mix it up just a little bit and ask each of them to highlight from their bio anything that is particularly pertinent to our subject today, but they all have extensive biographies and are quite impressive. So they're either in your program or on the app, and so I suggest you review them there. But we're going to go down the line and have them just highlight a few things of their choosing from their bio. The other thing I've asked them to do is to comment on, mention anything that they've learned, been a highlight for them, surprising for them, since this is the last day of the Conference on World Affairs, and most of them have been active participants through the week. So we're going to start with John Haven.
Okay. Thanks very much, and thanks to all of you for coming out so early on a Saturday morning. I want to thank you also for eschewing the reading of the bio. It's mine. Either makes it sound like I can't hold a job or I'm old, which may be true. So thank you for that. I'm an economist. I'm in from Marin County in California. I've had a variety of jobs that economists might have, most of which involve thinking about economic policy. I am currently both an independent consultant and I run a nonprofit that's designed to increase economic policy literacy nationwide. I could go into what that nonprofit is, but I'm going to in my broader comments, so I'll kind of leave my intro there. As for an important takeaway from the conference, there are so many. He asked us to come up with something just 5 minutes ago. But one thing that really stood out came from a panel yesterday that I think was entitled, "Is Honesty Passé?"
Do you have a microphone you can use?
We are struggling with the AV, the amplification, and so if you would like to come closer, that would be a welcome thing. So anyone...
And perhaps people could speak up just a little
yes,
bit.
Yes.
Look toward the audience.
Yes, come close, and we'll try to all make it work today.
Okay. Come on, John.
Sorry, carry on.
That's all right. Yeah, so the panel, I think, was entitled, "Is Honesty Passé?" And there was a lot of conversation in the panel about trust and the trust that we put in people that aren't necessarily a part of our lives, but we rely on for lots of services. You go to a restaurant, there's an enormous amount of trust that you're putting into people to prepare your food. You get into a taxi, an Uber or a Lyft, an enormous amount of trust. And how I think, you know, if we could take that trust that we're not all really conscious of and apply it to the rest of our lives, we might be all a little bit better off for it.
Okay. April.
Thank you. Good morning. Delighted to be here. This is my third CWA, and I care a lot about this topic. So I think kind of for my intro, it's going to be a little bit bullet point fashion because there are a few things that I think do qualify me to be here in some perhaps traditional and less traditional ways. So when I was 7, my parents put me in charge of my budget for everything. They said, you've just learned how to add and subtract, time to apply it. This means underwear, school supplies, everything. So, how old do you think I was when I started my first tiny business? 8, because I realized things cost money. How old was I when I made my first investment of $20 in the stock market? 13.
Oh my.
And I'm really, this whole notion of financial literacy, financial independence, was drilled into me young for reasons I didn't quite understand then, but even 1-2 generations later, much more important. When I was in college, both of my parents died in a car accident. I had to deal with a lot of this. I had a very modest upbringing, but when it comes to what matters and legacy and how do you make sense of planning for the next 80 years of your life when you're 20, I had to do that. I didn't have a backstop. How was I going to be self-sufficient? That sort of thing. Fast forward again. I have my law degree and I have a degree in finance, focusing on international finance and development economics. So I've been really interested in what does economic empowerment, livelihood, income generation look like globally, particularly emerging and developing countries, particularly looking at things like inequality, both within countries and between countries. And so I've spent a lot of time in this impact investing world where you're investing not just for financial return, but for social and environmental returns. And I've done that in a whole bunch of countries with a whole bunch of cultures and different economic structures and that sort of thing. So I'll leave it there with just one footnote. What fascinates me today, not just the intergenerational piece, but also as we look at a world where we have our biggest challenges that we face as a society globally are borderless. We have a lot of problems without passports, so to speak, but we're not yet developing borderless solutions. And I think that the investment world at all ages, we're in the early stages of a mindset shift in terms of how we look at identification of problems, but then investing in the solutions to tackle them. So that's my brief intro. Oh, I'm actually going to, I was going to refer to the same thing. So CWA panel, I'm proud to say I was on that panel, Honesty is Passé, and I loved it. And I was on that panel actually with my husband, who is another CWA speaker, so that's always one of my favorites. And I was blown away by the minister that we had on the panel, who really put this spiritual wrapper and underpinnings around how we think about trust and how we think about truth. And I found that incredibly rewarding. So, thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. Connor.
Hi, my name's Connor. And I guess I'm qualified for this panel because I'm kind of in this generation switch. I'm 26 years old. My family came from very rural Ireland and kind of, you know, came to America for the American dream. So I've kind of lived it firsthand of, you know, coming from a very farming, you know, fishing background, which we still go back home every summer. To, you know, my dad was, he raised us into a middle-class family, and now it's kind of how do I take his hard work and his success and bring it into my own life, as well as kind of try to bring, I guess, the next generation up to speed. And I think, in terms of my experience, I think the breadth of my background with sport, travel, has really made me realize that in order to pass the economic torch to the next generation, we just need to make the world a smaller place. You know, technology makes a child, for example, in Southern Africa, access the world from where he can't access it already. And do we look at, you know, say, if we want to talk about passports, you know, make more opportunities for younger students to travel abroad, to experience the world from a different lens and learn from cultures, has really made an impact on my life. And that's kind of, I guess, my story there. In terms of the CWA itself, this is my first conference here. And I think with a lot of the negativity and pessimism in the news today, it's just been enlightening. The entire conference has been enlightening. It's been inspiring. There are brilliant people on this panel and on every panel, I'm sure you guys know this week. And it's just uplifting, honestly, that there's hope, there's a passion for change. And I think it's, you know, we're going to make the world a better place. Thank you.
Thank you, Colin.
Good morning. Before I start, I'd like to recognize all the students. If you're a student, raise your hand, please. Raise your hand. Be proud. Raise your hand. Hi. Round of applause. This panel, this topic is all about the next generation. It's about you guys. So the fact that you've taken ownership and life responsibility in your own hands, that tells you something, right? It's not your parents, not your grandparents, not somebody else that's going to dictate your future success and finance. It's going to be you. The fact that you're here, you separate yourself from everybody else. So thank you for being here. So my name is Nathan Nguyen. I'm an author, speaker, and also a business owner. When I was, I immigrated here from Vietnam in 1991. My parents, I was born in Vietnam. And coming over here, we're on welfare. And one of the things that when I remember, I got a scholarship from the Horatio Alger Association. I met a lot of very, very successful people. And reading through their bios made me conclude one thing. They knew something that I didn't know. And majority of it was money, finance, economics. And so when I came back, it was in high school, I started to think about what can I do to help my family elevate. I'm youngest of six. So what does that mean? I can fail and they won't even notice me. They can rely on my older five siblings and that's okay. So I'm willing to be the pioneer and take the risk. So I went out and I got my securities license, my insurance license while I was going to school at USC, University of Southern California, getting my bachelor's degree in business administration with an emphasis in professional unemployment, aka entrepreneurship. So I started to get all of my degree, you know, my licensing and insurance and securities and got a little more. But the problem was when I was 20 years old, it's really hard to advise people about finances when you look like you're 11. So my only client was myself. So I ended up just doing that. And so I used my own knowledge and then got out, got mentorship and ended up starting a few companies. And fortune would have it and luck and some great mentorship. By the time I graduated USC, I was interviewed on CNBC Live, which I didn't know, I was so embarrassed about. I thought I was going to edit this. They spotlighted me as a young college millionaire. And I was like, wow. So could you edit that? Because I stuttered all the way through. They said, no, we couldn't edit out your stuttering because 22 million people saw you live. I'm like, you should have told me that. And I says, well, so afterwards, I realized, I just realized being on campus here. I graduated college 11 years ago, but I still look like I'm still in high school. The one thing that I would say struck at me was I got married 4 years ago. I became a dad. I have a 3-year-old and 1-year-old, and that's when really things really got to perspective. What can I do for the next generation? And so I've come back to speak at USC for many years. You know, in their business classes. But one thing I'm really passionate about is how can we teach financial education for the next generation? That's why I published my book, Money Smarts, and Air Credit Gain, because for me, finance is a skill. You can't, you know, sleep on the book or read a book and expect to be thrown in the deep end of a swimming pool and learn how to swim. You'll drown. And that's how a lot of people financially drown, is because it's a concept they've read, but without the skill, can't do it. So that's what my intro, that's what I'm passionate about. One thing, highlight in CWA, this is my first conference, I saw snow fall. I've seen snow on the ground. I saw snow fall for the first time in my life yesterday. So that's why I'm a excited. I'm super excited. I'm 33, and I'm proud to say I saw snow fall for the first time here. So, thank you, everybody.
Well, that's fantastic. Okay. Before we, I realized I made I missed a couple key elements here. So, before they go into their little longer statements about the topic, I need to, A, state the topic. The topic today, just for the record, is passing the economic torch to the next generation. How will upcoming generations prioritize long-term economic principles? What values will influence how and where money is spent? So that's the topic. And questions are at the heart of this format, of the way we do the CWA. And so there's two ways to submit questions. You can do it via the app if you've already downloaded it and are familiar with it. It's a great tool. I'll receive your question up here. If you want to have one of our producers give you a pen and a card, you can write your question down there and then give it back to them, and they'll bring it up to me. And if you're a student, thank you for coming, and note that you're a student at the top of the question or in the app, and your question will receive priority. So there we go. Now on to a little more elaborate discussion, and we'll take your questions after we go back down the line again.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Mark. Before I really get started, I want to echo something that Connor said about experiencing different cultures. For as long as I can remember, I've had a favorite or a pet policy prescription that I think is totally impractical, but I think would be a super good investment, and that is taking everybody when they turn 18 or 20, I don't care, send them to some other country so they can experience some other culture and see that people live differently, and it's okay, right? So, as I said, totally impractical, but I think it would work wonders for modern civilization.
Yeah.
Okay, so on to the topic. So the next generation, I'm not sure if that's Gen X, Gen Y, I guess I'll also call millennials or Gen Z, but I don't think it really matters. The next generation, those are the folks who are coming up behind my generation. I'm this far into the boomers. But they're going to have a lot of important things to deal with, and sort of understanding their perspective and where they're coming from is important. So I'm really glad that we have the rest of the panelists here. The panel calls for a little bit of forecasting, right? What is the next generation going to bring to the table in terms of economic desire? What are going to be spending priorities? Forecasting is not foreign to me. I used to run an economic forecasting firm, and we were one of about three firms to forecast the Great Recession. I always say the recession was very, very good to us until it was very, very bad to us because everybody ran out of money. I played a forecaster on TV during that, so that was fun. But forecasting what intergenerational changes, that's a little bit new. That's outside of my box. But I think that the endeavor that I'm currently working on gives me some insight into what might be coming. So NEED is the National Economic Education Delegation. I started NEED about a year and a half ago in response to my growing unhappiness with the abuse of economics in most public policy debates. Right? So politicians can get away with telling you virtually anything about economics that will justify what they want to do, because our electorate very, very light on economic policy literacy. And it occurred to me that, well, gee, the profession that I'm in, we know just a ton about economic policy. We don't agree on everything, but there is a core. For almost every policy you can imagine, there's a core set of valuable facts and information that economists are going to agree on. Right? What policy that takes you to, that's where we start to disagree. But if people could understand that core, I think that we could be better off. So I am mobilizing the profession to take the stuff that we know about policy and actually tell other people. Right? So what we do is we together write slide decks on individual policy issues. These slide decks are on immigration, are on income inequality, on safety net, on the U.S. economy, on the government debt. You name it, we're working on a slide deck. And then we're going to take the decks out to anybody who will listen, right? To groups like this. I've been speaking a lot to seniors in high school economics classes. They seem to really love it and absorb it. also give me some insight into the topic here today. So it's a long play. We're not going to change the world tomorrow, but hopefully over time we can get more people interested in economics and understanding just a couple of things about individual policies. Right? And then maybe when their politician stands up and says something, they can say, well, I'm not sure that's right, which doesn't happen nearly often enough. All right, so that's need, and where whatever insight I have into this topic comes from. My insights come, I think, from two different sources, and one is in the topics that are requested. When people approach me to give a talk, or approach one of the other delegates, like I mentioned, we have 400, Janet Yellen, Ben Bernanke, a couple of Nobel Prize winners, and former chairs of the Council of Economic Advisors are on our honorary board. So there is a lot of professional buy-in. But the topics that are requested, right? Okay, that tells me something about what's on people's minds, you know, whether it's in the classroom or other formats. And then the reaction that I get in the room, right? Maybe the topic expresses their interest, but am I telling them something that is new or that is different, or is genuinely of interest to them? So I think I've learned a little something through that process. And yesterday, I spoke to principals of macroeconomics class here on campus, which was really great. And at the beginning of the class, I asked them what policy issues are important to them. And they gave me three that stand out. One is climate change. One was Social Security, and one was immigration, right? And I'm interpreting their response being those issues in the following way, and maybe I'm superimposing my lens more than I should on it, but this is how I think the responses reflect. Climate change is perhaps more of a global outlook than a lot of people in my generation and more of a global outlook than people prescribe or ascribe to the coming generations. Social Security, I mean, there is concern about their individual well-being. A student, I think, was concerned about whether or not Social Security was going to be around when the time comes. And immigration, I believe that their interest in immigration as a policy issue comes out of compassion. Right? So I see global outlook, individual concern, and compassion as maybe three important features of the generation that's coming up. Notably, and even though I talk about it a lot, what is seldom mentioned is GDP, right? Economic growth. Economic growth doesn't seem to be high on the list of their concerns. Now, if our economy were to tank, I think it would go right back up there. But it suggests to me that maybe they're looking for something more than an economy that just generates a lot of income or an economy that just generates a lot of wealth. They're looking for something that's maybe fairer, that's more caring, something that's a little different from what we have today. So I guess what I take away is that perhaps the coming generations are going to be more willing to make sacrifices in an economic context than perhaps my generation has been.
Thank you, John. And a couple things first before I talk about my own perspective. Who knows what jazz hands are? I wanted to do this, but I was like, you all are going to think I'm strange if I do it on my own. So if you agree with something that someone on the panel is saying, jazz hands. If you're, and if nope, don't like it. This is a really great way to be more interactive. To show what you like, and this is a skill you can take out of this classroom as well. It's not as disruptive as applause, but it also helps us get a sense of, you know, what do you think? So just a thought, because I was like, John, yes. And then I thought, no, I can't do that yet. I need to.
Your husband was doing it.
Exactly, he was, exactly. So I picked it up from him, which made me think this is sort of like a public service announcement, because jazz hands are really useful for a lot of things in life. Secondly, you mentioned the I wish all kids, all young adults could get out and see something. Could not agree more. And one piece of my bio that I didn't mention, in between college and grad school, pretty much in the immediate aftermath of my parents' death, where I was trying to figure out which way was up, and had a lot of energy, had a lot of ideas, had zero accountability, was not ready for grad school, was candidly not ready for the real world. Life had kind of beaten me up a bit. I spent 4 years without a permanent address, with a backpack, a budget about yay big, I can make a dollar last longer than anybody, and the sole goal of seeing how as much of the rest of the world lived as I could, so that I could figure out how to be of service. Because one thing losing my parents had taught me was that it wasn't about making a bunch of money if you were going to die. You know, this was about people. This was about contributing to society. This was about being of service to others. Because without making this a therapy session, I didn't think that losing both my parents led to a very rational yet irrational fear that I didn't have long to live. And I carried that fear with me for some time, which is an amazing motivation to pay a lot of attention to what really matters. And I got really clear really young that it wasn't all about the money. But money is important because we all have obligations to meet and so forth, and money enables travel. But I bring that up because for any student, anyone out there, you said it was perhaps impractical. I would actually say it's one of the most practical, affordable things, far more affordable than one might think, to do. Connor and I were on a panel about making travel a lifestyle earlier this week, and it was one of my favorites. So I just kind of want to put that in the mix, because not only is that an intergenerational shift, I think that's going to be more and more table stakes for understanding and navigating the next generation, the economic shifts, how we look at problems, how we look at investments, and so forth. Very briefly, when I think about passing the economic torch and what we're looking back, looking forward, most of my comments today come from personal observation, come from working in the impact investment space, come from working with a lot of startups and entrepreneurs on one hand, public policymakers and governments on the other hand, around what I focus on for the last decade or so. One decade spent doing global development exclusively, so things like microfinance and base of the economic pyramid, if you've heard of that term. The last decade has been much more focused on this new economy, business models built through this, you know, where it's access over ownership, it's asset light, it's the experience economy, the sharing economy, the on-demand economy, all of which point to a very clear trend towards not wanting to own a lot of stuff, not wanting to invest a lot of money in having high overhead. And if a generation ago the goal, and I'm going to say here in the U.S. or in the West at least, but globally, the goal was own a house, own a car, maybe three cars, maybe a three-car garage, have a country house, have a boat. This was how you showed success, but also even to your family, this is how you showed you cared for them. The younger generation is like, yeah, that is not how I define what matters. There you go. That's really hard for parents to hear. Right? Your kids are saying, yeah, everything that you've worked so hard for, it's not that I don't love you and it's not that I don't respect what you did. I don't want any of that. We need to be putting our money to use to solve global challenges. We need to be tackling inequality. So where are we heading with this? So I'm trying to tease out, when we talk about values, there's both the individual level values and the differences between generations within families, for instance. And then there's also, at a societal level, the values, many of which John talked about really well. But this is where, and I mean, I guess there should be another panel on GDP as a thing, where GDP is one of the most outdated metrics we have, and a lot of young people are learning that's the case. So why is it that we're not so focused? Because if we're going to put money and economic growth before individual well-being or safety nets, we're living in a really warped society. And I do think that, especially with climate change and these, you know, you think about it, this is an existential problem. It is about humans' existence. If we can't figure that out, no amount of GDP, yada, 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 one country doing better than the other, it's crazy. So at the societal level, there's also a set of value shifts. And this sense of, when I talk about borderless problems, younger generations recognizing that if we don't look beyond our borders, if climate change is the perfect example, if we don't come together and solve this, you can't control climate change from one country to the other. We need to adapt our investment mechanisms and priorities as well. A couple things that I just want to add into the mix. I don't have the answer, but I think we really ought to be keeping this voice in the room. I'm constantly thinking about, like, who's here, but then what voices are we missing? Globally, the rise of the emerging middle class is going to also have a profound impact on intergenerational. I'm looking at this, you know, globally speaking, where, yes, here in a developed country like the U.S., where we're thinking, gosh, I don't want to own so much stuff. I want to be asset light. I'll invest in experiences, this and that. We have a lot of people in a lot of other countries that for the first time ever are able to own, are able to travel, are able to eat meat, these sorts of things. And there was a really interesting, last year for the first time in human history, the middle class became the majority of the global population for the first time ever. Now, until that time, the majority of the global population were poor. So, the global middle class is expected to double in the next 10 years. 5.2 billion people, all of whom will be able to buy more, see more of the world, be healthier, all of that. 5.2 billion people. Like, we are 330 million, something like that. Like, teeny. So we need, you know, when I think about the next generation, there is this awareness that in the U.S., we're a pretty small piece of the overall pie. We're going to need to understand these dynamics because they kind of are a counterweight to what we're feeling here. But when we look at things like climate change and inequality, this all comes in the mix. And I think the younger generation is much more aware of this than the older ish generation. And I find myself straddling the two, in which I do remember life before the internet. But I also have been very much focused on this sort of thing. So let me pause there because there's so much more we can dive into, and I'm curious to hear where there's most heat and energy in the audience. Thanks.
Yeah, so to briefly start off, actually, it was interesting, John, in your class, that one of the main questions was about Social Security and if it will be around for much longer. As students, you shouldn't even be considering that it'll be around. You should not be relying on the government or your parents or whatever is going to be, you know, there in the future, 50 years, that is going to take care of you financially. A little along the line of what Nathan said, we just have to take ownership of your finances. You have to take ownership of your life entirely. And I think I learned that from a very early age through sport, but you can also learn it through music or whatever skill or thing that, you know, say your parents throw you into. It's just taking ownership of your life early on. Obviously, April, you took ownership of your life very early. And then that'll enable you to grow as a person and really just rely on yourself, nobody else, going forward. From a broader standpoint, the idea of making the world a smaller place, I kind of want to echo on my comments earlier, by taking ownership of your life financially, by, you know, college, once you graduate college, and I know we've got student loan debt and that type of thing going on here, which is another issue entirely, but you should be able to make the world a smaller place for yourself and therefore make others' worlds smaller as well. I saved in college. I worked for Uber. I did night shifts. I did catering. I worked every little job that I could in order to save and travel. You just have to put that dedication in early. And I think that's, from my perspective, talking to some of even my friends and classmates, that's really lost on a lot of us, I think. I might even push back on something you said, April. I honestly think our generation loves to consume. We love to buy new clothes. We love to go out and spend $100 at a bar on Friday night, including myself, by the way. But we are consuming, and it can also be services as well as goods. We love consuming Netflix, Spotify, Facebook, everything. We are consuming services, I think, more than goods, but we're still consuming. And I think we have to take a step back, and the way that I've done that is through travel. By taking ownership of your finances, you can then save to travel, just as I said before, and then you really see that the world can be a much simpler place to live, to grow, to learn. Going to the Middle East, going to Africa, you know, people are happy. the emerging middle class is growing and they probably will start to consume more, but people are happy with very simple things. I'm moving to Japan on Monday, actually, and I've had to downsize a lot of my life. I'm going to be living in probably a 200 square foot apartment, ideally. So I'm taking my single dorm bed out of college, out of storage. I'm, you know, donating clothes. And like, okay, I haven't worn that in a few months, but I like it. Okay, well, no, let's get rid of it. To really just simplify your life. And I think by doing that and encouraging our children or the students of today to really take ownership of their own life in financial terms or sport or whatever, you can really make your world smaller. And then go forward without a dependency on the older generation, the government, your parents. And I think that in turn will shift the generation to be more reliable, to take action against these issues such as climate change, such as global migration, such as economic disparities, by basically making our own life simple, we can tackle the bigger issues that our previous generations weren't able to tackle before. So I just want to leave it there, and Nathan can definitely hammer more on the financial literacy part. But I think by taking ownership first, exploring the world through travel can really open it up.
Thanks, Connor. Yeah. Growing up, I was not a very studious kid, so I'm always asking why. And God has humor, because my three-year-old asked me five level deeps of why, and then another why, Daddy, why this. So God definitely has humor. When I was, I just graduated eighth grade promotion into, I guess, high school. My mom and dad invited me to my first big travel trip, go back to Vietnam. And it was unlike any family vacation. It's no resorts. It was visiting nine generations of grave sites. Visiting on my dad's side, on my mom's side, for 3 weeks. We didn't stay at any hotels, motels. We stayed with aunts and uncles. I was born in a house that was clay walls and dried leaves. So we stayed at relatives in that type of setting. And it was from that 3 weeks of trip that gave me perspective. It gave me a sense of why. You know, my father was a prisoner of war for 10 years, serving during the Vietnam War. So because of, so we were standing right at the bridge that separated the North and the South. And I could just sense the coldness that was beneath my feet, just standing there. And my mom and dad was explaining how much bloodshed was here. So coming back to America, I said, my gosh, this is truly the land of opportunities and milks and honey. What can I do? And it was always been a why guy. And so that's at that moment was when I realized I got to take personal ownership. I need to learn. I need to know what I don't know. Because the comment is yeah, you don't know what you don't know. But if you take ownership of that, I got to know what I don't know. And so fast forward, as I look at in terms of the macro economy, I look at the national economic health, I believe, stems and is rooted from the family economic health. But what's interesting is that home economics is cut from education. And so from a policy standpoint, I really care about education and how can we invest in human capital of the GDP. What can we do to invest back into youth? Home economics is out. Personal finance is out. What's interesting is colleges and schools teach accounting. Accounting for what? Other people's money, but not theirs. Which is really interesting. It's like all we learn is, I know how to do my manager's books, and I know my company, my employer, but for mine, I have no idea. And we never equate money with labor. A $1,000 iPhone is 25 bucks monthly payment. No, it's 100 hours of minimum wage. That is, if you're working part-time, that's 5 weeks of labor for an iPhone. If you ask that, hey, do you want to work for 5 weeks for an iPhone? or $25 monthly payment. And then we're moving towards a cashless society with everything where it's so hard to manage cash. I mean, we spend, you know, it's like Chuck E. Cheese, tokens now into a card. Casino, chips, and cards. Credit card, it's conditioning. We don't see our cash anymore. Starbucks, just load it up into your account, right? Amazon, load up in your account. PayPal's, I mean, money is no longer in our pockets or in our account. It's in other people's account. We can't track it. We can't manage it. And then we go, I wonder why we're struggling with money. And then we talk about, let's teach money. In a survey, it says over 80% of students rely on their parents to teach money. But then another survey says 69% of parents don't feel adequate or confident to teach. And then you say, but the parents say, oh, but we can rely on the teachers and the education curriculum to teach them. But then teachers surveyed, or over, was it 65% said, I'm not comfortable talking about money. I'll tell you a true story. This was last year. I was a teacher. I teach seniors, local high school, and we're doing this fundraiser. Student came up to me and says, Mr. Nguyen, I'm so sorry. I talked to this teacher next door and I made her cry. Said, what do you mean? Why would you make her cry? I said, I asked her to donate $25. And she sobbed. She says, oh my gosh, it's so embarrassing, but I simply can't donate $25 because I don't have the means. The student was freaking out. He caused a teacher to cry. And I'm freaking out. I didn't want to make the student or the teacher feel bad. But that is in the society we are in today. We're not comfortable. We want economic stability and we want, you know, financial wealth. But we're not talking about being, we're talking about just being able to meet our dreams and goals. You know, I think April will talk about the FIRE movement, for financial independence, retire early. So we go, how do you retire? It's very simple. Choose the lifestyle that we want and we live that makes us happy, and then find a way to make it pay for it. It doesn't mean wealth or riches or anything like that. It's subjective to every person. But the key is, how can we have the next generation still have goals and dreams and still believe in it? Believe that they can actually achieve it and have these goals and wants. Because if they don't have goals and wants, why would they ever want to have the why factor to actually put the effort in saving, put the effort in learning, and put the effort in doing what they need to do to accomplish these dreams and goals if they don't believe in the first place? So with that, I believe the fact that we're all here and talk about this is such a great topic, and it's a collective responsibility for all of us, for the prior generations to share their stories and give us experience, and for younger generation to take ownership. Thank you.
So we've gotten some great questions, and I'm going to take a student question first and add to it with a couple others. But I think this particular question, I'm going to read it verbatim and then do a little addition. As a millennial, it often feels like I'm swimming in a competitive culture with Gen X and boomers. Is there a way to change the competitive culture from my generational position and set a new paradigm for my work with Gen Z? And so some of the other ways to think about that is, the student has addressed intergenerational competition rather than passing a torch. It's like, well, you know, if you look at seniors today, in some respects, they are, you know, receive the greatest number of benefits, receive the greatest number of discounts, etc. So we kind of honor our seniors, and it is in competition with younger generations. And so the other question would be, what would policy look like to maximize the opportunity for future generations? I bring back the estate tax in a big way. What policies would drive greater opportunity for the next generation coming into the workforce in light of things like automation and et cetera. So policy and stifling toning down the competitive nature of the intergenerational wealth?
Sure. I will speak of policy and opportunity a little bit. I'm going to have to contemplate the intergenerational competition. So we are living in an era that is becoming unique in the United States in terms of income inequality and disparity of access to opportunity. If you look at some measures of income inequality, we're now at levels above where we were back in the 1920s, 1930. 50% of all the income in the United States goes to the top 10%. And that needs to change. Because part of what happens with that level of income inequality is that those who have don't want to invest in resources, and I'm overgeneralizing, of course, don't want to invest in resources for those who don't. Right? If you're in the top 10%, your kids can all get whatever education you want for them. So why do you want to pay taxes for education for everybody else, that sort of thing? So all of the conversation about wealth tax in the political arena these days, I wholly support. I think what we've done significant damage to equality of opportunity through the 2017 tax law, which was an enormous giveaway to the rich. So what we need is a generation of politicians, a cadre of politicians that recognize that by providing greater access to opportunity for everybody, in fact, makes all of us so much better off. Right. So to summarize my answer, right, we need much better distribution of income and wealth, and through that we need much better access to opportunity for everybody, not just those that have.
I'll chime in wholeheartedly endorse what John has said, and I will probably leave the policy piece mostly there, although I feel like there's a bit of overlap between, like, the competitive culture. There's a dance between policy and behaviors and mindsets and cultures and norms. And, you know, I've worked everywhere from Denmark and Sweden, where they have 80% marginal tax, and people pay it willingly and gladly. And then I work in a lot of emerging economies where they're really, like, the vast majority of people don't pay tax, not necessarily illegally, but they operate, you know, emerging markets. You're working in what they would call the informal economy. There is no tax structure, and there's no expectation amongst anybody that the lower income would be paying tax. But I really want to, this competitive piece, I feel like I do understand. And something that came up, part of this is a response to some of, well, all of you, but I think Nathan and Connor in particular, where for the older generation, and I don't mean to be, I am generalizing, so I will give that disclaimer. More is better. More is better. Growth is better than non-growth. God forbid we lose something. But more. Keeping up with the Joneses, one car, then two cars. Like, and that was normalized. And I'm not saying that's bad. I'm saying that's what happened. And that happened generally against a backdrop in which we didn't have a sense that resources, natural, financial, or otherwise, were limited. We could mine, we could drill, we could expand, we could throw plastics were amazing when they were first developed. The ocean was big. There was no way we were ever going to pollute the ocean with plastics. So there was more, and more is better. And this, you know, there's another debate here in which, can we get to a point where humans truly see one another as just equals? Children sure do. Out of the womb, we sure do. It's something we learn later on. But more and more, and again, generalizing, but relative to times past, I find with my, this is where I fall with the younger generation, if I may, not for many things anymore, but in this case, I have been laser focused for a long time on this whole more, like, it messes with your mind. You're never good enough. You're never, whatever. You don't have enough. Somebody's always, what? As opposed to this concept of enough, right? And I love the quote, greed is a little bit more than enough. And if we think about it, I think the FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early, Google it, there are some great articles, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, it's fascinating. FIRE is very much about what is your enough? And enough means enough to live a dignified life, but you are very actively pushing away the more. And I think that's much more aligned with where younger generations look at this race for more and never, and it's exhausting, it's expensive, it's not really good for the environment, et cetera, et cetera. And there's this sense of enough. Now, back to the competition, I could be really, just totally play the skeptic and be like, wait a generation, the competitive culture is going to die, and then we'll have something that's maybe. But to your point, and I don't mean to say that, younger generations don't consume, although I hate the word consume, and I hate the word consumer, and some of you have probably heard that happen this with consumer. I am an individual, I'm a customer, I'm a user, I'm a participant in society, I'm a free agent, whatever. Consuming of services, yes. I'm talking about asset light. You don't own a lot of physical stuff. That's what I'm really talking about. But from an environmental perspective, you're using fewer resources. You're consuming services and experiences and all of that and spending money on that. But from the perspective of, I got a lot of stuff, there's a very clear shift. And so part of me thinks there's an element of time that's playing out here. But there's also, I feel more and more that we just don't see these intergenerational kinds of conversations happening. And I feel like one of the easiest, lowest-hanging fruits is to start talking about it, like today, and having hard conversations within families and within, this is where it gets hard, but the people who aren't in the room today, like high-income, low-income, talking to one another, because final point that I want to make is they're absolutely right, this sense of ask why. Younger, why am I working for the man? Why am I working in a job I hate? Why am I so focused on why? Which is good, which is actually really good, because we don't just do what other people tell you to do. But also the sense of taking things into your own hands, which my only concern with this is, I do agree with that is the shift. But there's a balance and a dance and a really important puzzle here, where taking care of yourself and individual agency, but this is not a free-for-all, everyone for their own. There's an interdependence, most of all with inequality, that we have to acknowledge. We do rely on one another, and the only way that one is able to succeed individually is thanks to the generosity, collaboration, mentoring, whatever, of others. So, sorry, I went on.
As a former athlete, I think competition is a little bit of a good thing. You know, and this kind of goes back to the ownership piece, and there's great mentors and coaches growing up, and I think we need that. We learn from the older generation. But I think the one thing that we shouldn't stop with more is learning. We constantly need to be learning. And from a younger perspective, even I sometimes get complacent with this. I got a job at a big tech company, and you get really good at your job, but everything else kind of takes a little backseat sometimes, because you're so focused on your 9 to 5. You want to perform well. You want to impress the man a little bit, you know. But the learning, the outside learning gets left behind. And in today's world, especially from a technology's perspective, AI, machine learning, that is going to accelerate our technology faster than any of us, even me, can imagine at the moment. So, stepping back, learning soft skills. I think soft skills is another thing that this generation has not really taken into play. And taking outside learning courses, going to public events, getting on stage when you're really nervous and talk to an audience, and pushing yourself, taking coding courses, you know, outside of traditional lens. The majority of workers, whether you're an economist, whether you're in travel, you're going to actually be doing code 10 years from now, 10, 15 years from now. It's going to be all about data, big data, and everything like that. So taking ownership of that self-learning and not necessarily competing with the older generation, utilize what they have. Utilize their knowledge. Take it within yourself to learn from them, and then twist it back into, okay, how can I apply this within my own life? How can I apply this within intergenerational competition, which I think is a problem in itself, but it's real. If you want to take a certain path, you want to work for yourself, You're going to be up against other entrepreneurs. You're going to be up against other companies with similar ideas. If you're going to work for the man, there's 100 people per application to go work for the man. So I would say competition is a good thing in the way that it encourages us to push more our own boundaries of internal learning, our own comforts. You know, so if you're nervous speaking on stage, etc. I think everyone needs. I think, especially my generation, we need a little kick in the ass. I think to go forward. Yeah.
I've done martial arts and sports all my life, so competition is something I love. And when I watch the Olympics, I watch any type of championships. When I see a person winning the gold medal, what I always ask is, how did they get that medal? It's not because of their performance that day, but how much they practice prior to that competition. How much have they invested in themselves? Students, if you look around, how many of 50 plus do you see compared to students here? If you're looking at top competition, it's similar to what a panel I did yesterday, why Sears die and Amazon thrives. Sears, in 2017, invested 91 cents per square foot versus Best Buy, which should be dead compared to Amazon's electronic, but it's thriving still because Best Buy invested $15.36 per square foot. Because it's still reinvesting back in itself. So the question is, what can the students do to continuously reinvest back in themselves to stay relevant, to stay competitive? Because why? Your previous generation is still investing in themselves. Because if you're not, you're still not going to be, you've lost before you even competed. If you're not even here. So the fact that you're here, that's great. That's my first thing about competition. The second thing about the perspective of competition is this, let's not compete. Innovate. That's what I learned about the Japanese culture. They don't compete. They innovate. They get better. They level up. And so with students, I believe in younger generation, it's not about being better or being wiser or doing. It's about being more centered with your identity and being comfortable with who you are and what you really want to achieve and what would be the mark you want to leave in this world. It could be different. So instead of going to the red ocean versus blue ocean, compete in an area that is passionate with you, that you care about. And as a parent, I don't care what I'm most concerned about is my daughters knowing who they are and that they're going to do something that matters to them. And that's how I'm going to consider them as successful. And they're not here to compete with daddy. They're not here to try to be better than daddy. No. Daddy will see them already better just as who they are, and we love them to death. And so I think instead of letting that be a confrontation, let that be kind of like a springboard. Learn from them, ask them questions, and springboard off of them. That's that. And then regarding the distribution of wealth, I was looking at that chart, and I looked at wealth is measured on asset ownership. If the younger generation wants to be part of those who have, own things that appreciate in value and not things that depreciate in value. It's simply that. Young generation invests too many things like cars, phones, electronics that depreciates in value. Whereby if you invest in things and own things that appreciate in value, then you will actually be part of the pie chart that actually are wealth. Because wealth is a measurement of assets that you own that have value that appreciates. That's it. To get in the game, just know how the game is played and know the rules. Okay.
If I could follow up just a little bit, I mean, part of the reason I struggled with the notion of competition is because I'm an economist and we love competition, right? It drives most of what's good in the economy. The other reason I struggled was because I was trying to figure out what the definition of competition was that was being used. And I don't know that I figured it out, but one thing that occurred to me, and I was a little loath to say it, but I've experienced it with a lot of my employees over the years, and that is competition for jobs, competition for status, competition for position. And that will never go away until older generations just decide, okay, you know, yes, I'm 50, but hey, I'll step aside because you would like this job. There's with a lot of my employees who are a lot younger, there was an impatience. right? I mean, okay, you hired me into this job. I've done it for a little while. Now I want to, I want to do that job. And if that's the sense of competition, then I don't know. We need to figure out how to change that mindset. Go back to the learning, right? I'm not sure which one of you, maybe both or all three, mentioned, right? There's very healthy learning to be done from those who are above you. Just be patient and take your time and exploit that opportunity.
Okay, I have a slew of questions here, and we have about 10 minutes left. So we're going to do a little lightning couple. We're going to try to get as many questions as we can. I'm going to ask everybody to just fire away with your answer and move on, and we'll dispense with the applause each time, and let's get as much in as we can.
Yay.
Okay. Okay. Will wealth disparity continue to grow until we have a calamity, or will we change course before then, and how would we do that, and what sort of values will we exhibit? Will it be universal income, minimum wage, increases in the social safety net, innovation, entrepreneurship? But the first one is, are we headed for a calamity, or do you think we'll course correct on our track of economic disparity?
Yeah, so history suggests that it requires calamity to course correct. I'm an optimist, even though I'm an economist. I'm hopeful that we can correct course, and the conversation is growing increasingly towards policies that will help to correct course. That said, we are so far off course that even through those policies, it's going to take a long time to correct course, and there's so much that needs to be changed about the way our society functions, that I do worry that it might be necessary to have climate.
Very briefly, some of you may have heard of Ray Dalio.
Yeah.
Recent article, I just watched an interview with him. Part of me says, I know we're keeping it brief. Google Ray Dalio inequality last week. It's fabulous. He says very much similarly, and I, not that I'm like, oh, I'm just going to follow along, but agree that he's like, 70-30, 60-40, that it's going to be calamity, but it doesn't have to be that way. And every single problem that we are looking at right now around inequality and around climate change for that matter as well, which I believe are the two, those are the two zingers. Nothing else will matter more for anybody at any age in the coming years, full stop. Those two problems are one, and I don't mean to be over, dumbing this down, but they're 100% human created. We did this. So can we fix it? Of course we can. This didn't happen to us. This didn't drop from the sky. This wasn't, we human created problems, human created solutions, but it will require not only an enormous change, but as I've been learning over CWA, continued. Every 4 years things flip back and forth. This requires years of consistent, continued investment and leaning in the same direction as opposed to whipsawing back and forth.
I would echo on the policy thing a little bit. I think we need to be more proactive with policy regarding the economy and businesses and technology. I feel like today it's very reactive. I mean, the privacy scandals with Facebook and on social media. AI, machine learning, as I told before, is going to advance. I think I kind of share Elon Musk's sentiment here that it's going to spiral out of control if we don't be very proactive on ensuring that policy regulates it, that we ensure job transitions, because there are going to be many jobs that are taken by this technology, but how do we create more jobs with this technology? Because if we don't, I honestly think that the gap is going to even grow significantly more if we don't address these new emerging technologies and get out ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, one sentence, if we do our part, it'll work. Go back to you, Mark.
Okay. There's a series of questions here around debt. And so I'm going to combine both personal debt and national debt. And just quickly your views on Is there good amounts of debt? Are we way beyond that, both nationally and on a personal level, our levels of debt? But address debt and your views on debt quickly. Debt good, debt bad, get out of it. Need to borrow some more to solve climate change? What's your view on debt?
Debt good and debt bad. Are we spiraling out of control federally at the federal level? I don't think we're spiraling out of control. We're on a train that's sort of steadily chugging in that direction. I don't think that the level of debt is bad in and of itself. Because, you know, ultimately we don't really have to pay it off. We just have to keep turning it over. Not really the right way to think about it, but it's true. Where it comes into a problem is that the interest that we have to pay on it. It's going to go from 8% of the budget up to 22% of the budget, right? And that, you know, leaves very little room for accomplishing anything else, whether it's social policy, defense, or what have you, right? So it's going to be crowding out any of our other policy priorities. It's also the case that it leaves us with less fiscal room to deal with the next recession that will come. I don't know if it's this year, next year, or 5 years from now, but it's coming. It leaves us in a more precarious place. In terms of debt, I hold a contrarian view with regards to student loan debt. Other than the fact that we saddle students with too much debt because we charge them interest rates that are too high and we don't do it right. But the level of it I don't really see as a problem. The level of consumer debt, the level of debt that was racked up before the Great Recession, the level of savings is too low, so I guess that implies that I think that the amount of debt that people take on is too high. And it does make us vulnerable to when situation changes, in both cases.
I'm just going to focus on the personal debt end of things. Bias, I grew up in a family where my parents never paid anything but cash for anything. So that will give you a sense of whether I think debt is good or bad. I think that debt net, not good. Not helpful, not only because it gives this future obligation that you may be paying off for the rest of your life, but also it keeps you from pursuing opportunities that you may really believe in. And I think we see that nowhere more than graduating students. That said, I think that very specific, targeted, intentional amounts of debt that will leverage a future opportunity XYZ, great thing. But when it's thought through, not when it's just basic consumer, need this, need that, if you haven't thought through where it fits into the budget. And the hardest thing for me is to see the levels of average debt that we have. One is, it indicates not an inability to care for long-term financial needs. And some of you may know, 46% of Americans in a survey last year, 46% would not be able to come up with $400 in an emergency. That, to me, is scary. But debt as a one piece of a puzzle that includes sweat equity and salary and all of like makes sense. But this goes back to financial literacy, unless you know how that puzzle fits together. Those are table stakes for any of this to work.
Credit card debt, horrible. Financial literacy needs to really, I think, echo on that. Like, you should never, ever have to, pay just the minimum payment on your credit card. It's horrible. It's really bad for, obviously, your credit. Debt, if you're investing in yourself, is incredible.
Yeah.
The ability for, you know, people to take out millions of dollars to start companies or, you know, leverage, say, venture capital is a huge form of debt in a way. And taking, you know, little bits of debt to invest in your education. I mean, I know there's a student loan problem, but if you're investing in yourself, I think debt is good.
For me, what I love about America versus my country in Vietnam is that you can actually borrow money. Now, the question of debt, I think there's a whole way of looking at it from different perspectives, good or bad. The way I just boil it down to make it very simple for me, because I'm a simple guy, it's what I do with it. If I'm going to borrow people's money, other people's money, and do something that's not going to generate more value, or I can pay them back, that's bad. But if I can take other people's money and create more value and pay them back, I'll do it every day and all day long, every moment I can do it. Example. One of my first things I did after high school was I bought and sold real estate. I flipped houses. I borrowed other people's money, I flipped it. When I first started my business, I applied for a credit card. I used that credit card because it floated me for 30 days where I can pay it, right? So I was on to pay it in full. I used those 30 days of free money, buy something low, and sell it high. That's it. So for me, is good or bad depends on what I'm going to do with that money. And in terms of student loans, so that will be the next panel, is what I'm going to do at college. Too many students are taking on all these debt, but they're not understanding that they got to make sure they get a return on that investment. So maximize these opportunities that are given. Only a few students are here right now. What happens to other students? They're taking debt too, but they're not here. They're not maximizing their investment to get the best return.
Yep. That, I want to echo a couple of things, right? So the difference between the kinds of debt that's personal is also at the national level, right? Mm-hmm. Giving billionaires tax cuts, that's not a good way to go into debt. Building roads and schools and things that are genuine investments, yes, that we should be borrowing to beat the band, especially 2.5% to do all that kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Okay. It's 10:10, and even though this has been fantastic and I have stacks of questions here, we're going to conclude. I want you to give a big hand to our panelists. This is a big thing.